Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Planet Havoc by Tim Wagoner. Narrated by Joe Hempel. 1. Long-range sensors have picked up a ship. These were not the words Luis Gonzalez had wanted to hear, but they hadn't been unexpected. How far? Luis asked.
A little over 500,000 kilometers.
That's the outer range of the sensors, isn't it? Luis's hands tightened on the arms of the command chair. He might have been commander of the Kestrel for this mission, but it was his first time flying this ship. Hell, it was the first time for any of them. And he wasn't as familiar with its systems as he'd like.
That's right.
Can you tell what it is? Junior McManus was a big British man of African descent, and he had to hunch over to work the computer screen in front of him. His large hands looked ill-suited for anything other than breaking things, but they flew deftly over the controls.
Readings aren't clear, but my guess is that it's a light frigate. Out here, that probably means a coalition ship.
A large wall screen that looked like a forward-facing window dominated the room, but which was actually a computer recreation of the view outside the ship. It felt like a window, though, and that's how Luis tended to think of it. He grimaced as he stared at a hazy blip nestled among a field of stars displayed on screen representing the other ship. The Kestrel was a caravel, a small craft, less heavily armed than a frigate but faster and more maneuverable. Plus, it was fresh out of the shipyard. The Galactic Coalition encompassed a great deal of territory, hence the word galactic, and its forces were spread thin. The best crafts were reserved for admirals, coalition council members, and guild leaders. Soldiers had to make do with whatever craft they were assigned, and those ships were rarely top of the line. As old as the frigate was likely to be, its sensor range would be less than theirs, which meant that at this distance the Kestrel was for all purposes invisible to them.
Is this going to be an issue, Commander?
Jenna Woodruff, blonde with the merest trace of a Swedish accent, stood next to Luis's command station, her hands clasped behind her back, face utterly devoid of expression. She wore a gray jacket and pants with Leviathan's logo of a serpent coiled into a circle on her shoulders. She was the guild's representative on this mission, which meant that despite Luis's title, she was ultimately the one in charge. A woman of African descent with a shaved head stood on Luis's left, and she answered for him.
Whatever happens, we can handle it. We're the best. That's why you hired us, isn't it?
Cyrena Hancock was second in command on this mission, and Luis had worked with her for a number of years. He was used to her shooting off at the mouth, but Jenna wasn't.
Jenna glared at the other woman.
I wasn't asking you.
Cyrena glared back. Luis stepped in before the two could start arguing. He disliked Jenna as much as Cyrena did, but the woman represented the guild that was paying them, and that meant she had to be kept happy. To a certain degree.
You've given us a good ship. It's fast and has sensor deflectors. Prototype deflectors, he thought, but didn't say this aloud. With any luck, we'll be able to make planet fall without being detected.
Luck being the operative word.
I have full confidence in the ship, Jenna said.
As for its crew,
she gave Cyrena a last look before facing forward. Luis glanced at Cyrena. She was clenching her teeth so tightly he thought they might shatter under the pressure, but she didn't immediately lunge for Jenna and wrap her hands around the woman's throat, and he considered that a win.
Leviathan was paying Luis's team extremely well for their services, and he was certain that helped Cyrena restrain herself. Killing an employer's representative wasn't the best way to ensure you received your pay. Tensions were running high on the Kestrel, and it was a wonder they weren't all at each other's throats. The PKL system was off-limits to anyone but coalition military, and the penalty for unauthorized travel here was a lifetime prison sentence. No trial, no appeal, assuming your ship wasn't simply destroyed by a missile or mass driver projectile. No one Luis had ever spoken with knew why this system was forbidden, although he'd heard plenty of rumors. He was certain the Coalition Council knew, and he figured Leviathan did too. Or at least they suspected, otherwise they'd have never risked sending in a team. They were headed for planet PKL-10, nicknamed Penumbra, and their mission was to land, get something, and take it to a Leviathan research outpost several light years distant. What this something was, Luis didn't know. Jenna did, but she refused to tell the team until they landed on Penumbra. When he'd asked her why she wouldn't give them all the details of their mission ahead of time, she'd said, "In case we have to abort for some reason, Leviathan doesn't want you to be able to sell the information about why Penumbra is important. And some of you would sell it. You're mercenaries, aren't you? He had to admit she had a point. But whatever they were supposed to get on Penumbra, the almost obscene amount of money Leviathan was paying them made the risk worth it. A score this size, if Luis and his team pulled off the job, meant that they could retire if they wished, or, in his case, pay off a long-standing debt. It had hung on him like a crushing weight for so long he couldn't imagine being free of it. But he was looking forward to finding out what it would be like. The Kestrel's bridge was small. Space was at a premium on any starship, but more so on a caravel, and the bridge was crowded to the point of being claustrophobia-inducing. There were 9 people present, 4 more than Luis would have liked, but who had asked him? He was just the goddamn commander. The command station, a computer console in front of an unnecessarily uncomfortable chair, had been placed in the center of the bridge, and a quartet of workstations sat in front of the viewscreen. One was for communications and sensors, which was where Junior currently sat. Another was for weapons, and if the need arose, Cyrena would take that one. The third was for life support, including control of the ship's artificial gravity, where Aussie Dwayne Langa sat. And the fourth was for navigation, tended by Barge and Lachelle Bauer. 3 others stood off to the side, 2 men and 1 woman. Aside from whispering to one another occasionally, they remained quiet and kept to themselves. The man in the middle was a cyborg, and while he looked human, he remained eerily still when he wasn't performing a specific action. Cyborgs had that in common with androids, Luis thought. It was an easy way to tell them apart from humans, but it creeped him out a little. Not that he'd ever admit it to anyone. These 3 composed the documentary crew that Leviathan had insisted on sending to make a record of the expedition, as they liked to call it. The rationale for the trio's inclusion wasn't completely clear to Luis. Leviathan was a new guild, one that had grown swiftly and amassed a great deal of power in a short time. Maybe they wanted this mission recorded for propaganda purposes, the footage to be used both inside and outside the guild, assuming the mission was a success, that is. Luis's suspicion was the guild wanted the record in case their expedition went tits up, so they could better prepare the next batch of poor bastards they sent. Not exactly the greatest show of confidence. The cyborg, Orin, served as the crew's camera. When he was recording, his left eye lit green, and it was always green. When Jenna had first told him the trio would be coming along, she assured him that they'd remain in the background, quiet and unobtrusive, and everyone would soon forget about them. So far, that hadn't been the case for Luis. He always felt their eyes upon him, especially the cyborg's. He told himself not to worry about it. Maybe the holo footage would be a good advertisement for him and his team and lead to more Leviathan guild work. Assuming they survived, of course. 6 more personnel were currently in the ship's galley, which doubled as a lounge and tripled as a meeting room. It was just as cramped as the bridge, if not more so. But at least you could get a cup of coffee there. Luis wondered what the chances were of someone getting him a cup if he asked. Damn close to nil, he figured. Their course through the system had been plotted before their departure, using the latest intel on coalition patrol routes to ensure they wouldn't encounter any ships on the way to their destination. Based on the sensor readings showing their proximity to a coalition ship, it looked like that intel wasn't worth the money that Leviathan had paid for it. Luis felt a vibration beneath his feet then, accompanied by a queasiness in his gut. He recognized the sensation as a fluctuation in the ship's artificial gravity. Dwayne quickly worked the controls at his station, but several seconds passed before gravity was restored to normal. The crew members exchanged uneasy glances, and he knew what they were all thinking. Getting to fly a brand new, state-of-the-art ship was great, but they would have been a lot more comfortable if the craft had been given a proper shakedown cruise first before they'd been dispatched on their mission. Luis wasn't superstitious as a rule, but he couldn't help thinking of the gravity fluctuation as a bad omen. If any of the ship's systems were less than 100%, if he was forced to put any strain on them, say by having to avoid a coalition frigate, they might crap out when he and his people needed them most. He turned to Cyrena. She was the most intuitive person he knew, and he trusted her sense of how a job was going to go down, a sense that became sharper the closer they came to their objective. He didn't know if she was a psychic, but her instincts were good, and they'd saved the team's ass on more than one occasion. "What's it looking like to you?"
he asked. Her eyes narrowed in concentration. After a few moments, she said, I think I should go to my station. Without another word, she walked over to sit at the weapons console. What did she mean by that? Jenna asked. It means you and your camera crew had better find something to hold on to. Junior, can you switch the front screen to a view of the frigate's location? Junior sighed. Don't tell me. Serena got one of her feelings again.
Bite me, Serena said, but Junior did as Luis asked.
There was nothing to be seen other than a starfield, one that looked similar to the thousand others Luis had seen in the course of his career, both as a soldier and as a mercenary. Computer enhancement, Luis said. Junior's fingers worked the station's controls. The view zoomed in on a coalition frigate. Luis knew he was studying a simulation based on sensor data rather than the actual thing, but he got a cold feeling in his gut nevertheless. He debated the wisdom of increasing the Kestrel's speed. A sudden burst of acceleration could alert the frigate to their presence, but it could also put them farther outside their sensor range, so...
They've trained their sensors in all directions, Junior reported. On purpose or as part of a routine sweep? Luis asked. Unknown.
There's no cause for alarm, Jenna said. The Kestrel sensor deflectors will conceal our presence. She sounded less confident than Luis would have liked. The deflectors were, after all, only prototypes.
We'll find out soon enough, he said.
But he already knew what would happen. Sirena's instincts had told him.
2. Aisha Barakat sat in the command chair on the bridge of the stalwart, bored out of her goddamn mind. She was a tall, lean woman of Middle Eastern descent in her late 20s, young for a starship captain. The stalwart was her first command, and she'd initially been honored and excited to obtain the post, especially after the mess on Janus III that she'd been involved in. She'd expected to be court-martialed for that, at the very least, and as far as she'd been concerned, she'd deserved it. Instead, Coalition Command had made her captain of the stalwart for bravery in the face of overwhelming odds. That had been 18 months ago. Now she was ready to eject herself out of an airlock. It hadn't taken her long to realize that patrolling the PKL system was a shit detail and she'd been placed here as a punishment. Nothing ever happened in this system. Absolutely nothing. And she and her crew of three were bored out of their minds. Although she wasn't sure about Jason. Who knew what androids felt? Originally, Aisha and her crew were supposed to be rotated out of this post, but after the 12th month, Coalition Command had informed them they were required to stay on for the duration. When she asked why, Command had said only that the Coalition Council was debating what to do about the PKL situation, whatever that meant. She knew it had something to do with one of the system's planets, PKL-7, which she'd heard some soldiers refer to as Hell World in hushed tones, though none of them had been able to tell her the name's origin. The Coalition had erected a network of satellites around the planet, both for defense and surveillance, although defending or surveilling what, Aisha didn't know. She wasn't even allowed access to the satellite's data. That was transmitted directly to Coalition Command. She tried to hack into the satellite's network once, but she'd been unsuccessful, and she'd received a scolding from Command along with a warning to never attempt that again unless she wanted to spend the rest of her life in military prison. She figured if Command could have found someone stupid enough to replace her, they'd have done so. Still, she didn't try to hack the satellite network again. The stalwart was the only vessel patrolling the system, something else which struck Aisha as more than a little odd. If PKL-7 was so damn important, why would the Coalition have only a single ship in the area? After her first 2 months on the job, she'd contacted her superiors and asked. The response she'd received was short and blunt. Mind your own damn business, Captain. Her best guess was that Command believed the more ships stationed in the system, the greater the chance they'd draw unwanted attention to PKL-7. Too bad. If there had been more crews working the system, at least they could get together, drink synthetic alcohol, play cards and watch Hollows. If nothing else, at least there'd be somebody different to talk to now and then. The only outside contact her crew had was when they rendezvoused with a supply vessel every 3 months, and those crews didn't linger. They always had another supply run scheduled that they had to get to. In reality, most of what she and her crew did on the stalwart was maintenance. Not only was it an older ship, but most of its systems were automated, which was why only a few personnel were needed aboard. But automated systems could be finicky, and they tended to shit the bed at the least convenient times, so Aisha and her people spent most of their time putting out metaphorical, and sometimes literal, fires on the vessel. The stalwart did have maintenance bots, but the machines could only do so much. The bridge was typical for a military craft, all function without a hint of decor. Plain, unpainted plasteel made up the walls, and the workstations were simple computer consoles with thinly padded chairs bolted to the floor. The main view screen was a large rectangular section of wall, and while it worked well enough, there was a weird blue area on the bottom right corner, which bugged the shit out of Aisha. They tried fixing it, but they'd only made the blue area larger. Although it was against regulations, music played from speakers in all the consoles. Soldiers were supposed to always remain on high alert, and music was considered a distraction, but it kept them all from going crazy. Jason had chosen the current selection, crystal synth music created by the Lomai, a race whose hearing was 100 times sharper than a human's. Jason's android ears allowed him to appreciate the music. "Almost to the extent that a Lomai can," he'd once said. To Aisha, it sounded like broken glass being shaken in a metal canister. But after 18 months, she'd started to develop an appreciation of it. Along with Jason, who, like most androids, didn't have a last name, Aisha's crew consisted of Italian Lazara Fiore and South African Sal Hendrick. All three of them rotated between the stations to minimize the monotony, and sometimes Aisha would take a turn as well. By this point, they could all perform just about any task required aboard the stalwart, except cooking. Jason was their chef, and a damn fine one, which was more than a little ironic since he didn't eat. "Aisha, I'm getting some weird sensor readings," Lazara said from her station at Calm Sensors. "Weird how?" Aisha asked. Lazara was better at interpreting sensor data than anyone else on the ship, Jason included, so if she thought readings were strange, something was up. Lazara turned back to her console screen. "Sensors have detected an object that might be a ship, but according to the readings, it's there one moment and gone the next, like it's phasing in and out of existence." "Impossible," Sal said. "Not necessarily." Jason sat at the navigation station, and he turned around in his chair to face Aisha. "There are any number of naturally occurring space phenomena that could account for such readings. Quantum flux, hyperspatial distortion, etheric refraction, all of which are extremely rare," Aisha said. "Yes," Jason admitted, "but rare means unlikely, not impossible, and it could be something no one's encountered before. We should move closer and collect more data." Androids had a drive to accumulate knowledge, and Aisha wasn't surprised by Jason's suggestion. "Too risky," Sal said. "If we get too close and whatever it is damages our ship, it'll take help days to reach us. We could die before anyone gets here." He glanced at Lazara. "Assuming your readings aren't a glitch of some kind." Lazara's face reddened with anger. "I ran a diagnostic on the system before saying anything. Everything's in working order." "Run another diagnostic," Aisha said, "just to be sure." Lazara didn't look happy about it, but she did as Aisha asked. "Jason, let's get closer, but not too much closer. Not yet." Jason nodded a moment later. The stalwart's ion engines came to life, and Aisha felt a slight vibration move through her chair. Spend enough time on a starship, and you know its strengths and quirks as well as those of your own body. The stars on the view screen began moving as the ship accelerated. Sometimes when this happened, Aisha imagined that she flew through space under her own power, the way she'd pretended when she was a child riding on her parents' cargo ship. She was a magical being who could traverse the galaxy through sheer willpower alone. A silly daydream, but it amused her. "Second diagnostic came back as clean as the first," Lazara said. "Whatever's going on, it's not a problem with the sensors." "Is the object still there?" Aisha asked. "Yes, it's still flickering in and out of existence. It kind of reminds me of..." Lazara trailed off. "Yes? Do you guys read the tech updates Command sends?" "Of course," Sal said. He sounded offended by the implication that he hadn't done so. "Naturally," Jason said. Aisha shrugged. She'd never been big into tech. All she cared about was knowing how to operate a piece of equipment. As long as it functioned properly, she was good. Weapons were her only exception. She could use, maintain, and repair any gun command issued to its soldiers, and she always read the weapons updates command sent out. But tech updates, not so much. Lazara continued. For decades, pirates, smugglers, and traffickers have sought ways to evade Coalition ships' sensors, but the tech has never been reliable. They're getting close to perfecting it, though, and the current generation of sensor deflectors work decently enough, if only at a distance. They tend to cut in and out, resulting in readings like what we're getting now. Aisha leaned forward in her command chair. Finally, something was happening.
Cut the music, she told Jason, and he did so. Lazara, keep a constant scan going. If the object is a ship with sensor deflectors, the closer we get, the less effective they'll be. We should be able to get a decent read on them then.
On it, Lazara turned her attention back to her console. Jason, switch us to weapons. Sal, take over navigation. The men complied, and Aisha felt the crew's excitement building. She was right there with them. A year and a half without a hint of action. And now they might be preparing to confront a ship equipped with stealth tech and a crew breaking the Coalition's ban on non-authorized travel within the system.
Stay frosty, she said. The last thing we want to do is make any mistakes because we're too gung-ho.
Her crew exchanged glances. They knew what had happened on Janus III, and they knew of Aisha's role in it. They'd never treated her poorly because of it, but they understood why she'd given the warning. Aisha's face reddened with shame, but she continued nonetheless.
Lazara, can you get the ship to render some kind of sensor image on the main screen?
I'll do my best.
A moment later, a hazy object appeared in the center. Gray with fuzzy edges, it fluctuated in size, sometimes growing small enough to almost vanish.
Doesn't look much like a ship to me, Sal said.
He sounded disappointed.
It's too soon to tell for certain, Jason said. But I know of no natural phenomenon that produces an image like that, even when rendered from incomplete sensor data. I'd say the odds of it being a starship of some sort just went up dramatically.
Aisha's pulse sped up. She had never commanded a ship in battle before, but she'd served as bridge crew on other vessels as a junior officer. She hoped she'd learned enough from her captains to get her and her own crew safely through the next few minutes, whatever they might hold.
The object sped up, Lazara reported. Not a lot, but it's definitely going faster.
They wished to stay outside our sensor range without making it seem as if they're fleeing, Jason said.
My thoughts exactly, Aisha said. Sal, burn the ion engines at max for a few seconds. I want to halve the distance between us.
Are you sure that's a good idea? Sal said.
Aisha couldn't believe what she was hearing.
Are you questioning my order?
No, it's just...
Sal looked at her for a moment. She thought he would say something, but instead he shook his head.
Nothing, he said, and turned back to his station.
There it was again. Janus III. The stalwart was her first command, and she'd been given it, not as a reward, but to keep her isolated in a post where she couldn't make any more trouble for the military. Even though the Coalition had additional ships in adjacent systems to ensure no one breached the PK system, the planet PKL-7 was surrounded by a powerful satellite defense that would repel any ships attempting to land on its surface. The patrolling stalwart and its crew were little more than an extra precaution, and they all knew it. Aisha might technically be in command, but since being stationed on this ship, this was the first time that anything had actually happened. And now that they were finally seeing some action, Sal revealed that he didn't trust her judgment. No doubt because of Janus III. Despite herself, she couldn't help but wonder if he was right to do so.
Don't think like that. You have a job to do, so quit throwing a pity party for yourself and get to it.
Jason, can the engines handle the strain? She asked.
The android paused before answering, which for him was a long time.
Theoretically, he said. Good enough. Do it, Sal.
Yes, Captain.
The vibrations running through Aisha's chair and the floor tripled in intensity. At the edge of her hearing, she thought she could detect the whine of the engines as they were pushed to their limit. The artificial grav generators also functioned as inertial dampeners, so other than experiencing a slight pressure that pushed her back into her seat, she felt nothing from the stalwart's sudden acceleration. Sal cut the burn after 3 seconds. The ion engines weren't designed to perform at that capacity for long, and even a short burn was risky.
How are the engines?
Sal glanced at a readout on his console screen. They're going to need a tune-up after this is all over, but they're good for now. Aisha let out a soft sigh. She hoped no one else heard it.
Lazara?
Re-rendering image. The fuzzy gray blob sharpened into focus. It was indeed a ship, a small one.
It's a caravel, Sal said. I've never seen one quite like it, though.
That's because there isn't one like it, Jason said. At least, not one recorded in the Coalition network.
As an android, Jason was capable of interfacing with any computer, and he always connected to the ship's main systems while working at one of the bridge stations. He'd no doubt searched the ship's entire memory for a match to the unknown craft in the time it had taken Sal to speak.
Could it be of non-human origin? Lazara asked. From a race unknown to the Coalition?
Highly doubtful, Jason said. It's not an exact match for any Coalition-made caravel, but it shares too many features with basic Coalition design.
Hail them, Aisha ordered Lazara. Then to Sal, she said, push the ion engines as hard as you can without tearing them to pieces. Caravels are fast little bastards, and if they get too much of a lead on us, we won't be able to catch them.
No response to our hail, Lazara said.
Keep trying. Let me know if sensors pick up any indication that they're charging weapons.
Caravels were built for speed, not combat, so the craft wouldn't be heavily armed. They'd be carrying a small complement of low-yield missiles and maybe a mini-mass driver. But that would be it.
Sal, have the nav computer project the ship's route, Aisha said. I bet a week's pay they're headed to Hellworld. What else is there in this system for them to be interested in?
A moment later, Sal said.
You lose, Captain. The computer says they're headed for PKL-10.
Aisha frowned.
Really? Jason, anything about that location in the ship's memory?
There's data from the initial survey of the system, but that's nearly a century old. The planet's mostly barren, with little water and few signs of life. Some primitive plants and insects survive there, but nothing sophisticated. Its atmosphere is primarily composed of carbon dioxide, and its gravity is around 38% Earth standard. It's prone to sandstorms, and some of them kilometers wide and quite intense. He paused and then continued. There are several current mentions of the planet in military databases which refer to it as Penumbra, but I can find no additional details.
Could be that anything else is classified, Lazara said.
Aisha thought the same thing.
What's the other ship doing?
Still moving away from us at the same speed, Lazara said. If they were bothered by us leaping forward with an ion burst, they haven't shown it.
Weapons?
Still offline as far as I can tell.
Jason, do you think there's any significance to the planet's name? Aisha asked.
In astronomy, the penumbra refers to a shadow cast by a planet or moon during a partial eclipse. It also refers to the lighter area around the dark core of a sunspot.
Aisha thought for a moment. You put the two definitions together and you get a shadow of something.
But a lighter shadow, Lazara said.
Sal frowned. What would it be a shadow of?
PKL-7, perhaps, Jason said. It's the only known object of note in the system.
So Penumbra is the not-quite-so-dark shadow of Hellworld, Aisha said.
That doesn't sound particularly inviting, does it? Does it have any planetary defenses?
I can find no reference to any, Jason said.
Then if there is anything there, it's evidently not worth protecting, Lazara said.
Which begs the question why our new friends in the caravel would risk so much to go there, Aisha said.
I think we should pay them a visit and ask in person. Sal, squeeze out as much speed from the ion engines as you safely can.
Let's catch up.
Sal looked worried, and Aisha thought he might protest her order, but he said,
Yes, Captain,
and did as commanded. Jason, bring our weapons online. I want them to know we aren't playing games.
That might cause them to flee. Their ship is faster than ours.
We've cut the distance between us in half already, and our weapons have a greater range than theirs. I'm willing to take the chance.
As you wish.
Jason began tapping commands on his console. Aisha watched the image of the caravel on the viewscreen become larger.
Who are you? She thought. And what the hell are you doing here?
3.
They've spotted us, Junior said. Lousy goddamn Leviathan tech, Luis thought.
Aloud, he said. Maintain current course and speed.
Let's see what they do.
Jenna motioned to the camera crew, and the cyborg began moving his head.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?